Okay, it's 9 o'clock. Let us start. We're going to finish up with the Ben Ishchai, and hopefully within 15 minutes or so, and then this will be the first class of Rav Elchanan Wasserman. It is December 15th, 2014. This is the sixth class of the semester. There's only one more after this. Last class we ended, I was talking about the Ben Ishchai and the idea of bat mitzvah. And I think the last thing I said was that when a girl becomes 12 years old, he says you should she should make this an important date. She should wear her Shabbat clothes, and wear a new garment, and say Shachianu if she can. And she should have in mind the fact that she is now a bat mitzvah. He also says, and I don't think I mentioned this last class, that some people have the practice every year of making their birthday like a Yom Tov, and this is a good thing to do. So already, I mean, the idea of a birthday, is that something positive, or is that Chukas HaGoyim or something else? The Ben Ishchai mentions it. But the Ben Ishchai also says that there is no practice to make a seudah, a festive meal, a seudas mitzvah, on the bat mitzvah day. However, there are those who have quoted this Ben Ishchai and have said that even though this wasn't the practice in Baghdad to do that, it would be a good thing if the seudas mitzvah is done, and the Ben Ishchai becomes a major source for recognition of the bat mitzvah for girls, whereas the Ashkenazim all dealt with all these problems. If you permit the bat mitzvah, is it going to lead to the conservatives being validated or anything like, or some things like that? In the Sephardic world, they never had these issues. Let me conclude, or just about conclude, the discussion of the Ben Ishchai with the following, taken from my new book. And you can even see the picture of, there's the volume, the Rav Pealim. And if you look here at Simon, let's see, where's the... I don't know where my point... Oh, here's my pointer, here. Right here. Simon Hay, this, the artist did an unbelievable job here because I sent him, I just sent him a page. And he turned the page this way. He gave it color because the page I sent him was black and white. I don't know how these people do it. And, it's not such a problem putting the red mark all over it, but what he did with the page, that's, I find it amazing. So what is this responsum here, number 5, which is blocked out? And many of you who have the Rav Pealim, if you go online to HebrewBooks.org or Otzar HaChachma, you won't see, on one of them, you'll see a big blank space where it says Siman Hey. And another one, you'll see a different responsum substituted for Siman Hey. That's because, on the face of it, what I'm going to tell you now is an example of censorship. Much like the censorship for the Rush Bomb that I wrote about, and I have to tell you all, those listening live and those who will be listening in a few days, out of all the posts I've done, like around 60-some posts, over 1,000 pages already, I don't think I've ever had the same response as I've had to this post dealing with the censorship of the Rush Bomb. I have received probably 40 different emails from people I don't even know, not to mention people I do know, people sharing theories as to what led to it, pointing out that other people have also censored this, inside information from Art Scroll, all sorts of things. So people are interested in censorship, and hopefully when the book comes out, they'll buy it as well. But what you have in this tshuva, which of course you can't read now, but Siman Hey, is that... In the Rav Pealim, Rav Yosef Chaim states that there is no prohibition with trimming one's beard. As a mekubal, he doesn't believe in cutting off one's beard, but he says there's no prohibition in trimming the beard. The problem is this is also a difficult position to put forward as a mekubal, because a standard view, about, at least among most Kabbalists, is not to cut one's beard at all. And many Hasidim, I shouldn't say many, I mean, in general, the Hasidic world is very stringent on this. And here you have Rav Yosef Chaim saying there's no problem trimming the beard. To complicate matters even further, in his in his work written under a pseudonym, the Torah Lishma, he says, he contradicts this and says, you can't trim your beard. So we could see why people would assume that this responsum and Rav Pelim is problematic. It goes against the standard Kabbalistic view that you shouldn't trim the beard. It is contradicted by what he writes in Torah Lishma. And that could lead to a justification, I think, for people to say, well, this is an inauthentic responsum, or he changed his mind, or anything like that, and to delete it. Or simply to say that we don't want people to know about this responsum. But I think in this case, the matter is actually more complicated. I discuss it in the book, because normally when you're dealing with censorship, the people censoring know that something's authentic, but for a variety of reasons, they don't want it in the public eye. They think if people know about this, it'll be dangerous. Maybe it's a halachic position that is no longer accepted. You don't want people to know. I give numerous examples of this. So one of my best examples, I think, most interesting, is Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach in dealing with Lashon Hara. He disagrees with the Chafetz Chaim and believes that it's okay for husband and wives to speak to each other, even if it's Lashon Hara, because they're sort of like one unit. And he regards this as l'toelet, that if a husband is having a difficult situation at work, he could tell his wife, and it's not regarded as Lashon Hara. That is contradicted, though, by the Chafetz Chaim, and this position of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach was censored. That is not reprinted after it appeared. And that's the point of the book. Hundreds of pages of similar sort of thing that with the changing environment, changing outlook, positions that used to be acceptable are now thought to be unacceptable for one reason or another and are completely censored. The censor knows the truth, but he does not want people to know about this for, as I said, a variety of reasons. Das Torah, halachic uniformity, name it, you name it, and I can give you examples of it. What the reason for censoring the Rashbam is, That I'm not entirely clear, but let's leave it at that for now. However, this case I just mentioned, I don't think it's a classic example of censorship. And I mentioned this in the book. Because the fact is that there were scholars from Baghdad, scholars who had no dog in this race, or no horse in this race, I should say, and nevertheless said that their tradition is that this was not written by Rav Yosef Chaim. And Rav Mordechai Eliyahu stated that if there was even a small possibility in his mind that this response was written by Rav Yosef Chaim, or actually in the mind of the people who printed the book, they would have included it. In other words, and I don't have time to go into the details now, but the evidence is that the people who cut out this response of Rav Yosef Chaim did not believe it to be authentic. So that is, in one sense, it's censorship, but it's not censorship of the sort that I dealt with in the book, where people, for one reason or another, don't want others to know the truth, and they want to keep it secret. They really thought, authentically thought, that this responsum was written by someone else, and it got mixed up in the Rav Yosef Chaim's papers, and was published posthumously, but it was not written by him. So normally, just to repeat, the censors are aware of the truth, but decide that their goals are best served by removing material from the public eye. In this case, the censors honestly thought that this was not written by Rav Yosef Chaim. A few other interesting points. Today in the Haredi world, there's all sorts of discussions about women in the public sphere. Can they have public positions? In fact, since we're speaking about Iraq and Rav Avadya Yosef, tradition is obviously Iraqi, although he departs from it. But his daughter, Adina Bar Shalom, reported today that Aryeh Deri agreed that in a future Knesset, women would appear as deputies for the Shas party. I find it hard to believe, first because I can't imagine that the Council of Sages would agree to that, but even more importantly, I don't think there's going to be a Shas party in a few years. If you've read the Israeli news, you know that Eli Yishai, who is apparently much more popular than Aryeh Deri, has broken off to form his own party, and that's going to be a party to include religious Zionists, it's to include the Masorati voters, to have a much wider range, whereas the current party, Shas Party, it has two members on the Moetzes Gedolei Torah, one of whom called the religious Zionist rabbis Behemot, and the other one, Shalom Cohen from Porat Yosef, referred to all the religious Zionists, that includes people like me and you, as Amalek. Not for naught did Rav Meir Mazuz, who was the spiritual leader of Eli Yishai and is now in place to become the most important, not just Sephardic rabbi in a religious sense, but also in a political sense, because Eli Yishai's party, according to all polls, is going to be bigger than Shas party. But he referred to Rabbi Shalom Cohen, they call him Chacham Shalom Cohen, and he refers to him as Choshech. That is Chacham Shalom Cohen, he calls him Choshech, because he sees him as a force of darkness. And he explained this very clearly, that originally the Shas party was supposed to be made up of the Shin, Shachor, that is Black Kippot, the Charedim, and the Samech, for Surugot, Kippot Surugot. That is, the Shas party was supposed to be a party for the entire Jewish people, the Charedim, the religious Zionists, the Masoretim. And under this new leadership, they've turned it into not just a Haredi party, but a super Haredi party, and therefore that's why he gave his blessing to Eli Yishai to form a new party, which would represent the Sephardic voters. They call in English sometimes, they refer to the Knesset members as Knesset deputies. Actually, deputy is the wrong word. They might call it that, but members of Knesset. Ellie says, where do we see Simon Hay with that view? Well, you can't see it unless you have an original copy of the volume, because any one you get, the reprint in 1980, the one you'll see on HebrewBooks.org, the one you'll see on Otzer Chachma, is the censored version. I have the actual version, and in the book that'll appear hopefully in a couple months, not sure exactly when it's going to appear. It'll appear in March, they say, although I sent back the proofs last week or a week before last, and there was all sorts of problems, so I have to go through it again, or maybe even a second time, or a third time, that is. And I include the page, which I was able to get from Jerusalem, the Jewish National Library. I was not able to find a copy of the original volume anywhere in the United States. Yeshiva University Library, I think it's YU, it might be JTS, I can't remember now. One of those libraries has the first printing of the Rav Pealim, which is in Jerusalem, the early years of the 20th century, 1910, 1912. However, they were missing that volume. But you'll see a picture of it in the book. So getting back to what I mentioned, in the idea of women, you know, for years there wasn't any issue about women's pictures. The Haredi newspapers had plenty of pictures of women, and what could be wrong with a picture of a woman who's modestly dressed? But I guess around the last 15 years or so, it's become standard in the Haredi papers not to have any pictures of women. And that's really how you know if a newspaper is Haredi or not. You look at if they have pictures of women. And even pictures of girls they cut out. It's gone to such an extreme. What I pointed out a long time ago on one of my blog posts, and I was quite surprised no one ever mentioned this before, but Rav Yosef Chaim, in his Rav Brachot, another volume of Talmudic discussions, he was around when really photography just started getting going. And he writes how it's, and he's coming from obviously a much more modest sort of, I shouldn't say modest, a society where women are kept much more behind the curtain than they are today, and he writes against women's pictures. He speaks about this new instrument, the photograph, and how it's, you don't want to take pictures of women because what it could lead to. He obviously wasn't dealing in a society where women are in the public eye all the time. He wasn't dealing with society where everyone takes pictures of themselves. This was a brand new item, but he does say that you shouldn't take pictures of women. So that's in his book, Rav Brachot. Continuing along these lines, I just want to mention a few more other interesting things before we end. In his response, Rav Pealim, we learned so much about the Jews of Iraq. One of the things we learn is that there was at least one, maybe more, Jewish pimp. And he was asked, that is one who runs prostitutes. Can you give the pimp an aliyah in shul? And he says that it is forbidden to do so, even if the prostitutes were only with non-Jews. The implication of it is, I have the volume. Actually, let me hold off on that because I don't recall offhand. This is in volume 2, Orachaim number 18, and I can't recall. He's referring to non-Jewish prostitutes. We have cases of Jewish prostitutes, but that's not what he's referring to. And he's saying, even if it's only with non-Jews, you still can't give him an aliyah. I mean, you can make the case that non-Jews are not required in astringent sexual mores as Jews, but that's what he rules. In Ben Yehoyada, along these lines, speaking about sexual matters, he discusses something which I've written about, and a number of tshuvot appear on this. Is a Baal tshuva, it says in the Gemara that a perfect repentance of a Baal tshuva is when you confront the exact same situation as before, and you are able to overcome your inclination. Now, this could apply to anything. It could apply to with non-kosher food, but the implication really is a sexual sin. You're in the same situation to commit the same sexual sin as you once did, and you're able to overcome your inclination. That is a true repentance. There were rabbis, and not just rabbis, leading figures who came to an idea which strikes many, myself included, as I've mentioned this already, completely really unexplainable, but that they think that this is a positive thing, that someone who's trying to be a Baal Tshuva should purposely put himself in this situation. The Notabi Yehuda attacks this. He says this is crazy, but the Klei Yakar, famous commentary on Chumash, says that the Baal Tshuva who wants a complete repentance should do that. There's other sources that mention that people try to do this and then they succumbed a second time. So it's hard to understand what's going on here. Rav Yosef Chaim, however, says that he agrees with the Klei Yakar, a Baal Tshuva can do this. He says a Tzadik Gomer, a real Tzadik, cannot put himself in such a situation. You might think a Tzadik should put himself in such a situation, then he can overcome his inclination. And that's a great mila, you could say, a great achievement. He says that's absolutely forbidden. But he also agrees that a Baal Tshuva, you have to assume that the Baal Tshuva is able to overcome this. But again, who knows? Do you get to the situation? But he does say that a Baal Tshuva can put himself in this situation if he chooses to. I don't know what to say other than I find this completely strange. But that's what he says. And he's not the first to say that. In his Ben Yehoyada, which is his Talmudic commentary, you'll find this in Brachot. No, sorry, not Ben Yehoyada. In Rav Pealim, he has an interesting question here. He was asked if secular subjects can be taught in the synagogue. That is, as part of their before they had schools, they'd sit in the synagogue, they'd learn. Can you also teach them secular subjects? And he quotes a responsum by the rabbi of Rome, Rabbi Yisrael Moshe Chazan, who quoted a responsum of one of the Gaonim. Where were the Gaonim? Gaonim were from Iraq, stating that you could do that. You could instruct in, let's say, mathematics, so-called secular subjects in the synagogue. The Ben Yishai rejects this and says that Rabbi Yisrael Moshe Chazan doesn't understand that it used the way it was then, and still, I guess, in his own day, is that it's like our shuls. That is, you have the sanctuary, and then you have other rooms. And the Ben Yishai says what the Gaoni mean is that in the building, you could have instruction in secular subjects. You cannot have instruction in the actual sanctuary. I mentioned that we learn a lot about Baghdad customs from Rav Yosef Chaim of Baghdad. Let me just tell you one of these customs, because I think it's significant as it contradicts the Shulchan Aruch. We learn from a responsum of Yosef Chaim that women in Baghdad did not tear kriyah upon the death of a close relative. This contradicts explicitly what it says in the Shulchan Aruch, that not only men but women as well do kriyah. We all know that. You could imagine how there would be a position in the Gemara or the early posting that say for modesty reasons women do not do kriyah, and they actually rip it. Is a way they rip it, but that's not the halacha. The halacha is explicit, and that's already the Gemara decides this. And yet, for one reason or another, the practice in Baghdad was that women did not do kriya, and he regarded it as a valid custom, even though it opposed the standard halacha. And we have this notion of minhag mevatel halacha, which means that even though you have a practice that is in violation of halakha, nevertheless, it is allowed to stand, even if you can't explain why it's valid, then it, by all rights, it should be removed. However, if it's a practice of longstanding that previous great rabbis have validated, or maybe I shouldn't say validated, but not publicly opposed it, you can assume that there must be some reason why the earlier generations of great rabbis permitted it, even if though it violates explicit law, and therefore we allow it to stand, especially in a case of what we call a sheval taseh. And that's an example of minhag mevatel halacha. I have a long, long article I'm working on. It. Maybe now I'm on vacation. Just yesterday, the semester ended for me because I finished all the exams. Hopefully I can finish this article. This notion that there are customs that are allowed to stand, even in violation of halacha, is found for 1,000 years already. We have this, and it's something that most people don't realize. They assume if a minhag goes against halacha, it cannot be a valid minhag because it goes against halacha, but that's not the case. We have a principle called minhag mevatel halacha, and there's disputes among the tshuvot about this. Some say that that only refers to monetary matters. Others say no, it refers to all sorts of matters. And here's an example of it, that this practice of not tearing kriya is in opposition to the halacha as we know it. Nevertheless, Rav Yosef Chaim allowed it to stand. Everyone listening here knows that the United States moved into Iraq. We had a war in Iraq. And one of the things we did there was we took over all the government buildings. And lo and behold, in one of the government buildings, in the basement of the Iraqi intelligence headquarters, they found, and I'm reading a document right now from it, we found approximately 2,700 books and tens of thousands of documents. These were confiscated by the Jewish community from Saddam Hussein's government. These were all brought to Washington, where they were microfilmed, they were digitalized, and some of them have already been put online. The rest will be put online, and this is regarded as a great treasure. We have it still in America now. The problem is that the American government has stated that they're going to return it. There's going to be a lawsuit if there isn't already. The Iraqi Jewish community overseas, not the ones who are living in Iraq then, have protested. Jewish organizations have protested. The position of the State Department is that the Iraqi government wants it back. They see it as part of their heritage. And America, when they took it out, they assured Iraq that it would be returned. I see no validity to this whatsoever. Yes, the United States might have told the Iraqi government, and the Iraqi government, I don't think the Iraqi government had any say in this matter, that they gave permission. There was no permission to give. The United States was controlling the city then. But be that as it may, the United States government did tell the Iraqi government, we will give it back to you. And even if they would have only done it with the Iraqi government's position, as far as I'm concerned, that's neither here nor there. The Iraqi government has no rights to these documents, to these books. These were stolen. These were confiscated by the Jewish community. They are the property of the Jewish community. The United States has no right to determine, you know, where these items belong. They obviously belong to the Jewish community. The Jewish community of Iraq does not exist in Iraq anymore. These documents must therefore go to a committee, represent a Jewish community, and I'm assuming they will end up in the state of Israel, or they should end up, because that's where the Iraqi Jewish community is, and that's where the Cairoese, I'm not Cairoese, that's where the Syrian, the Aleppo Codex is. Not long ago, about 10 years ago or so, it was just an article about this in one of the papers. Other medieval Bibles were smuggled out of Syria, but the Iraqi government has absolutely no claim on this whatsoever. In addition to that, there are also books and manuscripts that are not in the United States possession. They are still in the Iraqi National Library, and I can actually send anyone who's interested a link where you can pull up the... despite the fact that there's a war going on in Iraq, there still is a National Library open. There's a catalog online that not only has Arabic, it has Hebrew as well. on the catalog, the names of these books. Who in Iraq is capable? Maybe they got of doing this. Maybe they got some Palestinian who knows Hebrew who's able to catalog it. I have no idea. There's a group of people in Israel who have, I'm reading something now from online, I can send anyone the link, they have been in touch with the preservation staff at the Iraqi library, and there are materials there from Rav Yosef Chaim. In fact, there's on this blog I'm reading from, it's called Giloy Milta B'Alma, if anyone wants to check it out. It says, look what it says here, manuscript findings in the Iraqi Jewish archives. This is referring to, though, not the archives I'm talking about are not the archives in Washington, D.C., where there's also stuff, but the archives in the at the Iraqi National Library. There are unpublished stuff from the Ben Ishlai. Most of the manuscript stuff already appears in various writings, sometimes different form. But I'm just looking, for example, one thing, which is a Bakasha prayer for the 7th of Adar, invoking the memory of Moshe Rabbeinu. That does not appear anywhere. And yet it's held by the Iraqi National Library. Fortunately, they're putting all this stuff online, so no Jew needs to take a chance and travel to Iraq and see it. And finally, the last thing I want to mention is three things I found in this book, Rabbeinu from Rav Avadya Yosef, whose relationship with the Ben Ishlai is obviously a loving relationship, but it's a critical relationship as well. But I found three things I'll share with you, and with that we will end the Ben Ishlai. On page 14, he tells us that the Ben Ishlai was, he speaks about how the Ben Ishlai was able to change customs because of his greatness. And Rav Avadya says that I couldn't do that when I was in Egypt, but when I was in Tel Aviv, I was able to. And the example he gives is that it's a Sephardic practice among some Sephardim that when they do Birkat Kohanim, the Kohen does not say Yevarechecha. It begins immediately with the Kohanim, and Rav Avadya thinks that's wrong, and he was able to change it. Then on page 33, he mentions that he heard from one of the Iraqi rabbis that the Ben Ishlai, because he was always in his house, always learning, he did not know all the minhagim of Baghdad. I find this hard to believe, but because he did live in Baghdad and he grew up in Baghdad, and he wasn't a practicing rabbi, but he was the leading rabbi of the city. But that's what he reports from this Rabbi Sharabani from Baghdad. And he also said reported that the Ben Ishlai didn't hear very well. You had to write your questions out for him. But the idea that the Ben Ishlai didn't know the practices, and he gives an example of this on page 53. He says that the Ben Ishlai wrote that the minhag in Baghdad was that you did not marry from the 17th of Tammuz until Tisha B'Av. And that's, and Rav Yosef said that's not correct, that the minhag of Baghdad was indeed to get married from the 17th of Tammuz. And Rav Yosef, he quotes Rav Chugi Abudi, who was an Iraqi rabbi, who says, we absolutely did weddings from the 17th of Tammuz to the 1st of Av. How to explain this? I don't know. I can't imagine that the Ben Ishlai, who was the leading rabbi who decided how half of the whole city, didn't know what the customs of the city were. Maybe there was more than one custom going on, and the Ben Ishlai's circle was one thing. That's what Rav Avadya says. This becomes important in Rav Avadya's career, because when Rav Avadya Yosef is elected chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, he changes the practice. The rabbis of Tel Aviv refuse to marry people, anyone, Sephardic or Ashkenazic, beginning on Shivat Arba Tammuz, even though the traditional Sephardic practice is only to refrain from marriages from the first of Av. The Sephardic rabbis, according to Rav Avadya Yosef, were too solicitous of the Ashkenazi rabbis. They wanted to kiss up to them, I guess you could say. They didn't want to. They wanted to show that they'd be good, you know, good followers. And Rav Avadya says it was wrong, that they should be following us, he believes. And he comes into his office, and he immediately changes that. He changed something else as well. He made a lot of changes, but I like this change, the next change. Before he came in, the Tel Aviv rabbinate, which gave Hashkacha for Pesach, they would say, if something was kosher for Pesach, but it had kitnios, it would say not kasher, lo kasher, except for those who eat kitniot. Rav Avadia changed it and said kasher le Pesach, kosher for Pesach, except for those who don't eat kitniot. Because he said, this is the land of Eretz Yisrael, we follow the Shulchan Aruch. If you don't want to follow the Shulchan Aruch, that's fine. And Rav Avadia apparently thought that Ashkenazim, at least when it came to kitniot, could not break this custom as a group. As individuals, he thought you could become Sephardi, but he has a responsa about kitniot, so he assumes that people will still keep it. But nevertheless, you have to know what's the priority. That is, this is kosher for Pesach. Those who have the custom of not eating kitniot, they don't eat it. With that, we end the 5.5 classes dealing with the Ben Yishchai. We will now move on to this important individual, Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, Hashem Yikom Damo. But before we start, let me just take if there's any questions on the Ben Yishchai. I'd like to end our Ben Yishchai classes that I enjoyed very much. So if you have any questions on the Ben Yishchai, send them in now. I'll take a couple minutes. If not, I'll move right into Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, because I don't want to start talking about the Ben Yishchai at the end. We're moving from Baghdad, smack in the Sephardic world, to the heart of Lithuania, the heart of the Torah society that was Lita. So we don't want to have a shotness, a kitnios here, not a shotness, a kilayim of the two. Yisrael asks, did we get to the topic of how Gemara stuff for Sephardim, like the Ben Yishchai differs from that of Eastern Europe? I did. You were not here that day. I remember one day you were not here, Yisrael, one of the classes, and that's where I spoke about their approach to Pesach. If you've heard the class and it doesn't answer your question, or if you get a chance later, come back to me. I can answer it in a future class. But we did discuss at some length the introduction to the responsa, the Rav Palin, where he talks about the different approaches to study between the Ashkenazim and the Sephardim. I see two people are typing, so let me wait two more minutes. Let's get a couple questions. And if not, if you're typing, you'll be typing something else that shows up on my screen, perhaps. But I'll give it two more minutes, and then we'll move on. I'm only going to take questions for about the Ben Yishchai 5 minutes, and then I'm going to move on. And at the end, if you have questions, I can come back. But I do want to start Rabbi Chanan. Yisrael asks, would interaction with a Rav like the Ben Yishchai be similar to that with Sharf Avadia kissing the... and slap in the face. I don't know. I think that was unique to Rav Avad Yosef. We don't have any description of what Rav Yosef Chaim was like, so it's hard to say. Yes, we spoke about Chukei Nashim last class, and I mentioned the censorship of Chukei Nashim, where the Ben Yishchai says that those people in Europe, I'm not sure if he knew about how all of Europe was. He did know about Western Europe. Those were the people he had dealings with who came from France, places like that. He said that those women who don't cover their hair and say that that's not the practice, he says, we cannot answer that. In other words, he seems to be acknowledging that for those people in a society where women generally go with uncovered heads, that they're not sinning. And that was, I mentioned, was censored. So we spoke about that last class. Okay, let's move on to Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, because I'll go for about 20 minutes or so on him, and then we will, if you have questions on the Ben Yishchai, I'll take them at the end when I take questions about Rabbi Chanan Wasserman. Rabbi Chanan Wasserman is going to be another one of these long units. I think it'll be longer than the Ben Yishchai, because his life encompasses, first of all, it's quite an interesting life. It takes us into the heart of the yeshiva world. It takes us to the disputes in the Ashkenazic world, Zionism, secularists, all the important things that happened in the 20th century, not to mention the fact that he himself is a very interesting personality, great piety on the one hand, great kanaut, zealousness, extremism on the other, strongly held opinions, in some ways not at all characteristic of the typical Lithuanian rabbi. On the other hand, he was front and center of the Lithuanian rabbinate, a very important figure, despite not being in line with most of the Lithuanian positions. It's also going to raise all sorts of issues Because here you have unquestionably a Gadol Yisrael, a great Torah sage, one who was martyred. So for that reason alone, he has to get the utmost respect from us. And yet some of his views will be regarded by people listening, I think, as abhorrent. And because he comes down in some ways just like Satmar. And today his writings are reprinted by Satmar. So if the Satmar ideology is abhorrent to you, then you'll see with Rabbi Hanan some things of that nature as well. So much so that Rabbi Tzvi Yehuda Cook refused to allow his non-Talmudic works, that is his works of Hashkafa, into the yeshiva library. Because it's not just opposition to Zionism. You'll see what he says. It's very difficult, some of the things he says, to read. And that's part of the paradox of Rav Elchanan. But of course, as a kadosh, I think we have to be more careful in, even if we reject his opinions or prefer other opinions, we have to be careful. Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook could speak this way about Rav Elchanan, who we knew personally, but we have to have some distance. Rav Elchanan Wasserman, whose picture you see now, this is a famous picture, there's some other pictures I'll be able to show you. I was born in 1874 in the Lithuanian town of Birž. If you know this rabbi at Lintop, who's a quite an interesting Lithuanian rabbi, he was the rabbi of Birž. But other than that, it's not a significant town, and he doesn't come from Yichus. His father was not a great Torah scholar. Most of the rabbanim we've spoken about have come from Yichus. His father was known as Banish the Shamus. He was the Shamus in the Shul. So although most of the Gedolim come, at least half of the Gedolim, I think, come from some sort of Yichus, great rabbis, rabbinic families, not Rav Elchanan. His family in 1890, so that's when he's 16 years old, moves to the city of Boisk in Lithuania. Boisk is important because Boisk is one of the places that Rav Cook is rabbi of before going to Eretz Yisrael. He's rabbi in Boisk and in Zoimo. And then he goes to Eretz Yisrael then to go to Yafo. Rav Elchanan and Rav Cook were very different sides of the spectrum, and I think you'll find it very disappointing to learn what Rav Elchanan says about Rav Cook later on. But in these early years, they had a very different relationship. Beginning in 1895, Rav Cook is the Rav of the Lithuanian town of Boisk. Shortly after moving to Boisk, Rav Elchanan goes to the Telz Yeshiva, the great Telz Yeshiva, which is not one of the classic yeshivot, going back to days of the Mir and the Volozhin, but it's one of the great yeshivas from the end of the 19th century. You put it together with Slabodka. You know, one of those great yeshivas. And, of course, those who've been listening in this year and years past know we spoke about Telz when we dealt with Rav Elchanan Wasserman, because that's where they had the great revolution of the students in Telz. He was there for 7 years. The Rosh Yeshiva of Telz was the great Rav Eliezer Gordon, and the second Rosh Yeshiva, remember this name, was Rav Shimon Shkup. The famous Rav Shimon Shkup, who later comes to Yeshiva Shvitz Elchanan for a year. Now, how do I know what the biography I'm going to be talking about? There is a two-volume biography, hagiography, I should say, of Rav Elchanan, published by the Haredi author Aharon Sarosky, where you get the basic facts. I use these facts, I elaborate on them, I'll tell you where I differ from them, and point out problems, but in terms of the basic facts of his life, you get that. The book was also published by Art Scroll. Here it is, the picture. It's called Rav Elchanan, The Life and Ideals of Rav Elchanan Binyamin Wasserman of Baranovich. They do not have the footnotes in this, which is full of important material, and they also cut out some things. When we get to it, I will tell you what Art Scroll has cut out from the original biography, and why they cut it out. But much of the basic biography you'll see in this book, although I'm going to show you very soon, if not today, next class, something which, based upon what Rav Elchanan himself writes, what appears in here cannot be correct. Sarovsky reports that Rabbi Chanan would come home for vacations from Tells, and he would learn with Rav Kook. This is quite ironic considering Rabbi Chanan's philosophy in later years. But the fact that he learned with Rav Kook is thought to be significant by Rabbi Eliyahu Zini for an unusual purpose. Rabbi Eliyahu Zini, I don't know if any of you know the name Eliyahu Zini, he's the rabbi, he's a rabbi in Haifa, and he's the Rosh Yeshiva, the Hezer Yeshiva, called Or Vishua. And they have an English web page as well. It's O-R, then V-I-S-H-U-A-H. He's Algerian. This is a Hezer Yeshiva. He has extremely right-wing politics. And as a Sephardi, he is unusual in that I think he's probably the only Sephardi who consistently goes after Avad Yosef, rejecting his views. I have all of his books. He has five volumes of a work called Eitz Erez, and he has a number of other books. And he has taken upon himself to refute Rav Avad Yosef, and he doesn't always refute him in the best language. He sometimes is very sharp with him, and I personally don't think it's so appropriate because Rav Avad Yosef was from an older generation. I mean, he's Rav Zini is probably in the 60s. Rav Avad Yosef was a previous generation. But he rejects Rav Avadya's idea that you have to get rid of Chutz La'aretz Minhagim, and he disputes with Rav Avadya about giving back land for peace, and he disputes across the board. Rabbi Eliyahu Zini, he also, and this is significant in its own right, he is the translator into Hebrew of the writings of Eliyahu ben Amozig. We had four classes on Rabbi Ben Amozig, and if you recall those classes, I spoke about how the editor thinks that some of Ben Amozig's points are too universalist, and he attacks Ben Amozig's point of view in the footnotes. Even though he's the translator and the admirer, he can't let stand some of these universalist statements. That's Rabbi Eliyahu Zini. If you're interested further, you can go to the website, and they have plenty of his articles, and he answers questions. But he was asked the following question, and this relates to what I just said, how Rabbi Hanan learnt with Rav Kook in Boisk. The typical question that students are always asking, someone writes to him, you can plug into the, if you want to see it yourself, plug into the Or of Yeshua website, there's a search mechanism in the upper left-hand corner, Gedolei Yisrael v'Tzionut, Jewish Torah leaders, Gedolim, and Zionism. And the question is, it's probably some yeshiva students. You know, yeshiva students are never very sophisticated. It's like they find out for the first time that what their rabbis taught them, there's another approach. I'd like to think that at least in our circles, we educate people so that when they get to, when they're even teenagers, they realize that our approach is not the only approach. So, be that as it may, someone writes to him that he read in a book called Atchalta Degula, Atchaltahi, which is a book about religious Zionism, and I concluded that many great rabbis support religious Zionism. But then he says, I also read another article from Rabbi Dessler, where we see the opposite. And how can I determine who's greater and who's more numerous? That is, you have rabbis who say one thing, they support Zionism, rabbis who say they don't. How do I know which side to go with? And then he says, in his question, and there are also great rabbis who were not on the pro-Zionist side. He said, you have the Chazon Ish, you have Rav Chaim Brisk, you have Rav Chanan Wasserman, you have the Satmar Rav, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, he says the Ben Ish Chai. So how am I supposed to decide which is the correct position? Rav Zini says, he says, to answer this question, it would require an entire encyclopedia or a book, because this is a very complicated matter. So I'm going to answer you briefly. First of all, he says, you give the Chazon Ish here as someone who opposed Zionism, but he says, when the Chazon Ish came to Eretz Yisrael, he wrote to Rav Kook, he referred to him as Kvod Hod Maran, that is, he regarded Rav Kook as the Mara D'Atra, as the Rav of Eretz Yisrael, and Rav Kook supported Zionism, and therefore, who's greater? The Chazon Ish himself asked Rav Kook his question on Jewish law as soon as he came to Eretz Yisrael. That, if Rav Zini was here, I have to say to him, maybe I'll write to him, but I see the way he replies, he doesn't take so kindly to criticism. I've only had one dealing with him. I wrote him a question about Ben Amozig, and I was surprised and actually happy. He actually knew who I was, And he wrote back, I just signed my name, you know, my hero name, Mel Shapiro. He wrote back, Professor. So he obviously knows something about me. But if I'd speak to him, I'd say that this is complete nonsense, what he just said. Of course, the Chazonish came to Eretz Yisrael. Rav Kook was alive. He came in 33. Rav Kook dies in 35. He had a shaila about what the minhag of Eretz Yisrael is. He wrote to Rav Kook. But 10 years from there, in 1943, you can't say that Rav Kook is greater. I mean, you can say if you want that Rav Kook is greater than the Chazon Ish, but you can't say it based upon the fact that the Chazon Ish wrote a letter to Rav Kook 10 years before. By that time, the Chazon Ish was his own man. And from the Haredi's perspective is concerned, he was much greater than Rav Kook. So leave that aside. And then he says about Rav Chaim, in other words, Rav Zinni's going to say a lot of things that are just completely false. I'm mentioning this to you because what he says about Rav Hanan is interesting. Then he says about Rav Chaim Abrisk, he says, Sheker who? This, it's false that he opposed Zionism. He says, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook stressed that he didn't support Zionism, but he wasn't against it. This is also completely false. First of all, Rav Chaim was not just opposed to Zionism. He was one of the leading opponents of Zionism, together with the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And furthermore, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook never said this about Rav Chaim Abrisk. What Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook said is that most of the Gedolim did not oppose Zionism. They just were on the fence. They didn't know. And he says the only two Gedolim who did oppose Zionism, that is leading Gedolim, were the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Rashab, and Rav Chaim Abrisk. So it's how could you say Rav Chaim Abrisk didn't oppose Zionism? There's a book. But see, Yehuda's point is that there's a book called Orlei Asharim, which is an anti-Zionist text published. And if you look at it, you have a few like second-level rabbis. The only leading Gedolim you have are Rav Chaim Abrisk and the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And Rav Yehuda sees this as a proof that, therefore, most of the other great Gedolim, they didn't contribute to this book because they didn't support the anti-Zionist campaign. They were in the middle. So Rav Zinni's first two facts are completely incorrect. But then it gets interesting. He says, and regarding Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, he was the son of the Shamash of the Beit Knesset of Rav Kook and Lita, so he knows that, that his father was the Shamas of Rav Kook Shul. And because of that, he learned all Arba Turim with Rav Kook. Again, I don't know if that's true either, that the reason Rav Kook learned with him, because his father was a Shamas, but he's right. He learned for many, many hours, months, with Rav Kook. And then Rav Zinni says, Az divrei harav, divrei talmud, divrei mishomim. So here you have a machloket between Rav Kook and between Rav Chanan Wasserman. Rav Kook is the Rebbe of Rav Chanan, so who do you listen to? Rav Zinni is a big fan and advocate of Rav Kook's teachings. His yeshiva published, they call it Chumash HaRe'iyah. They took, it's on Breishit, I think on Shmot as well, they took all the comments of Rav Kook on his various commentaries on Haggadah and other things, and arranged it in the order of Chumash. So you're reading, let's say, Parshat Vayechi, and you can see the comments of Rav Kook applicable to those passages in the Parsha. But again, I'd say to Rav Zinni, with all due respect, Rav Zinni, Divrei Arav, Divrei Tava, Divrei Mishomim, obviously, when Rabbi Chanan was 20 years old and Rav Kook was 40-something and they were learning together, in those cases, yes, Rav Kook trumps Rabbi Chanan because he's the Rebbe. But if you take Rabbi Chanan in 1935 or 1940, he's his own gadol and he has his own position. Now, I don't think because I learned with a rabbi when I'm a teenager, when I'm 20 years old, for the rest of my life, that means I can't dispute with him. If I reach a certain level and I have my own opinion, why, of course I can dispute with him. Rav Hershel Schachter disputes with Rav Soloveitchik. What are you going to say? Divrei Harav, Divrei Talmud? Because the Rav was Rav Schachter's Rebbe, you can't dispute with him. When you reach a certain level, you can dispute. I mentioned in my last forum post, it's the Rashbam, the text from the Rashbam, where it says he argued with his grandfather, not just his Rebbe, his grandfather, Rashi, and Rashi agreed that if he had to do a new Peirush, he'd redo it. The way the Rashbam thought was appropriate. You can always argue. This is Torah. You can always argue with your Rebbe when you reach a certain level. And but that's the sort of argument he's making. Then he says that he's correct when he says that the Sephardic Rabbanim were always in favor of Zionism. The Ben Ish Chai was not opposed to Yishuv Eretz Yisrael or anything like that. And his conclusion is that you know, you basically just follow the path you're on, the religious Zionist path. He says you don't need to decide between the Gedolim. You're not, it's nothing for you to decide. Just follow your teachers. He also says that there's no notion, even if you say that the majority are anti-Zionist, this idea that you follow the majority, that's only by the Sanhedrin. Okay. Enough with that. Let's move on. After leaving Tells, Rabbi Hanan goes to Brisk, where he spends, at least this is what we're told in, let me take that back. We're told in Sarosky's volume that after Tells, Rabbi Hanan goes to Brisk, where he spends 2 years in close study with Rav Chaim. I don't know how much of an influence Rav Chaim had on him, because if you look at his Talmudic Sfarim, you don't have Brisker analysis, what becomes classic Brisk. But this sentence, that after Tells, so let's see, he's, I don't know exactly the year he goes to Tells, but he's in Tells in the 1890s, and then to say he goes to spend 2 years in Brisk with Rav Chaim, that's what appears in Sarosky's biography. The problem is, I don't see how this can be correct. And why not? Well, it's actually pretty simple. We have a book here, Kovetz Ma'amarim Ve'igrot, two volumes this thick of articles, and we'll talk a good deal about these articles, and letters of Rav Chaim. And look what it says on page 31. You're going to tell me that Rav Chaim, that Rav Yitzchak Hanan was for 2 years with, learning with him for 2 years. Okay, I brought the wrong volume up here. So I'm going to hold off on this till next class, and you'll see how he couldn't have been with Rav Chaim, as is stated there. But I'm going to hold off on that, and I'll show you something else. I'll show you why I know that he couldn't have been in Brisk. I don't know if he went to Brisk at all. I think this might be a complete legend. He does go to Brisk, as we'll see later on, when he runs a small yeshiva. But this idea that he spent time in Brisk, I see no evidence of that. Not only do I see no evidence, I'm going to show you evidence just the opposite. In the volume I have here, volume 2, page 92, he says, this is also, I think, supports my point. This is a letter in volume 2. Actually, sorry, this is the thing in volume 1. I want to show you something else. This is volume 2. You have the book, page 92. It's a letter written in 1899. So this is around the time this is when he's in the Tells Yeshiva. Now, in this book here, Rebbe Hanan, on page 31, it speaks about how in 1897, I don't remember what year he was. I have to get the year that it says he, around, before this time, it says he went to Brisk. I don't have the exact page here, but let me show you why I have a problem with it. I actually have to look at it to get the exact year. He writes how in 1898, he was with Rav Chaim in 2 summers. And then he says in 1898 that I was with him here for only 6 weeks. And I was able to speak to him, to speak to his son, Reb Chaim. And he talks about how great that was. But according to, and that's the extent of his involvement in 1899 with Reb Chaim, the 2 summers. There's nothing in there about any extended time. Unless there's a screw up on the dates, and he went to Brisk later on. I don't know. I can't tell you. But one thing's for sure, that by 1899, he didn't yet have that. This letter I mentioned to you was written to Rav Yitzchak Kosofsky, who later becomes the brother-in-law of Rav Chaim Moshe Grzynski, and later becomes rabbi in Johannesburg. On the very next page of this book, page 93, you have something he writes after the death of the Maitreyer, Rosomo Palachek. In 1898, Rav Elchanan marries the daughter of Rameir Atlas. Yeah, I mean, we know 1898, he marries the daughter of Rameir Atlas, the Rav of Shavli. And then we know his entire life. We know exactly where he is. So when is he supposed to have been all this time with Rav Chaim Soloveitchik? I'm not sure. It's a mystery to me. I don't want to take the time now and try to find exactly the passage. It says on page in this book here, page 31, that he went. He spent 2 years in Rav Chaim's home, receiving personal instruction from Rav Chaim. And there, he begins his paragraph by, in the summer of 1897, he took a vacation. He became so connected to Reb Chaim that he decides to go to Reb Chaim's house, and he spends 2 years. If you read this, the assumption is that after 1897, he goes to study with Reb Chaim. The problem is, I just read you the letter from 1899, and he tells us the only time he's been with Reb Chaim is the summer of 1897, which is mentioned in the book here by Sarovsky, and the summer of 1898. Sorry, no, in the summer of 1899. So I don't know when. Summer of 1898, because it's Kislev the next year. So if he tells you that he's only been with Reb Chaim the summer of 1897 and the summer of 1998, and then in 1898 he gets married, and then he's off doing his own thing, when is he supposed to have been with Reb Chaim? Sarovsky assumes that from 1897 until he's married, he's with Reb Chaim, living in his home. But that's contradicted by Rav Elchanan's own letter. I think what you have here is that we do know that he spent a lot of time with Reb Chaim, and all the stories that Sarovsky assumes refer to this period, it's not true. And it refers to the later period, when he comes to become Rosh Hashiva and Brisk in 1910, if I recall. We'll get the exact date soon. It's like Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg. There are many, many stories about how he went to the Mir Yeshiva, and then from there he went to Slobodka, and then he went to Mir. And it's not true. He went to Slobodka, then he went to Mir. He was not in Mir two times, but there's confusion. In 1898, he marries the daughter of a Rav, who in his day was a well-known Rav named Rameir Atlas. He's the Rav of Shavli. Shavli is the city of Rav Yosef Zachariah Stern. Shavli is the city that Yehuda Leib Gordon was in. And it come down in history because he wrote a famous poem called Kotzol Shel Yud. And it's a story about an evil rabbi who, because the get is missing a little jot of the Yud, and it's not written properly, therefore this woman remains an aguna. And who is this evil rabbi who cares more about Jewish law, not just Jewish law, this tidbit of Jewish law, than keeping a woman, letting a woman go free? It's the evil rabbi Vafsi Hakuzari. Vafsi, Vav Samech Pei Yud. Vafsi Hakuzari, if you switch the letters around, it comes to Yosef Zachariah. That is Yosef Zachariah Stern, who was the greatest bucky of his time. Totally forgotten today, but an unbelievable gadol. He was succeeded by Rameir Atlas. If you look in the book Making of a Gadol by Nussan Kamenetsky, he says that Meir Atlas was the father of Samuel Atlas. Samuel Atlas, the Talmudic scholar, the close friend of Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg, who comes to America and teaches at the Hebrew Union College, the Reform College. That is not true at all, though. If you just open up Atlas's edition of the Chidushei Raivad on Baba Kama, which is found in every single yeshiva in the world of any substance, and it has the Chidushei Raivad on Baba Kama, which has Rabbi Weinberg's notes in the back, and it has the notes of Samuel Atlas, it tells you right in the first page it's dedicated to the memory of his parents. But that is incorrect. I see it's 10 o'clock, so we will end here. This is a good place to end. I haven't said much already about Rav Elchanan, but take my word for it. There's a lot of stuff to come, and unbelievable stuff we have to talk about Rav Elchanan Wasserman. But I'll take a couple questions if anyone has any questions already on Rav Elchanan. We've only done 20 minutes. Ira says, we should keep in mind that his opinions are expressed well before Hakamat HaMadina. Yes, yes. all these anti-Zionists, the people who were anti-Zionists before establishing the state, once the state was declared, they then said, well, they didn't become Zionists, but you have to support the state because Jewish lives are at stake. The exception is the Satmar and those people. But the Belzers were big anti-Zionists, the Vizhnitz, the Lubavitch, they were all anti-Zionists. And that changes. But nevertheless, you will still hear anti-Zionism of a sort with Rabbi Chanan that you don't hear with others. And it's no accident that it's his writings that are today reprinted by the Satmar. I mean, we're going to talk about disputes he had with his brother-in-law, Rav Chaim Moser. We spoke last semester a bit about them when we dealt with Reuven Katz and Avodah Ivrit. But his temperament was not traditional Lithuanian in a variety of areas. What kind of house would Rav Chaim have had that he could house a guest? It's an interesting question you ask. There are stories that babies that would be left at Rav Chaim's doorway would find a home with him. I don't think it means when it says he spent almost two years in Rav Chaim's home receiving personal instruction, which, as I mentioned, as far as I can see, is not correct. Nevertheless, he doesn't mean he actually lived in Rav Chaim's home. I think it means he got his room wherever it was, and then all day he was spent in Rav Chaim's home. There were lots of people in Rav Chaim's home. He would give shiur there. People would come and learn with him. So it doesn't mean he lived in his home. And you are correct. The Rav Chaim was very poor, and it was a small house. I plan on doing classes on Rav Chaim, maybe after Avad Yosef. Do you think there would be a copy of Rav Palim and Ashkenazi Yeshiva in Israel, United States? The book was reprinted in 1980. So any yeshiva that has a good library, what they call Otsar Sfarim, go to Yeshivas Hebron or Ponevej, they will have a copy of the Rav Palim. They will have the reprinted edition. If you're looking for that response about cutting the beard, you'll have to be patient and wait for my book to come out. You might, if you search online, you might find, in fact, you probably will find the text of the tshuva. But if you want to see the Tzura Sadaf, what it looks like, That you'll have to wait, because I can't send it. I'm not allowed to send out any of these digital things until the book comes out. You mean, did they have any regard for him as a poseg? Nah, they don't have much regard for him in the yeshiva world. They don't have much regard for any of the Sephardic rabbis, but they do have libraries, and libraries have Sfarim, and it's an important sefer of Psak. But in the Lithuanian world, Psak's not that important, and when they do Psak, they don't look at the Rav Palim, but I've been to the Otsar Sfarim, the library at the Lakewood Yeshiva. They have plenty of Sfarim there, which they don't use, but there's Sfarim. They buy the important works. They even have Rav Kook's Halacha Sfarim are found in the Lakewood Otsar Sfarim. I don't know if his Ashkafa Sfarim are found, but his Halacha works are definitely found. I know because I picked one up and looked at it when I was there. Yisrael says, not to focus on Rav Kook now, but did he change radically from his yeshiva days to Eretz Yisrael, such that once he was one of the gang, but seemed to start his own distinct camp? Already in Europe, he had interesting ideas, and he published some of them. But when he comes to Israel, it comes into fruition, and he, I guess you could say, creates a philosophy and ideology that wasn't there in Chutz Aretz. And that is seen as significant from the followers of Rav Kook, because the followers of Rav Kook distinguish between his Chutz Aretz Torah and his Eretz Yisrael Torah. His Chutz Aretz Torah is worth reading, but it is not at the same level of his Eretz Yisrael Torah. So you can't cite something from Rav Kook, from his essays written in 1895, 1897, 98, and say, well, he says this here. If he contradicts that in Orot and anything that happened once he came to Eretz Yisrael, the Eretz Yisrael writings trump the Chutz Aretz writings. And it's a different, I mean, the followers of Rav Kook believe that once he comes to Eretz Yisrael, he is raised to a higher level. And what they think is l'shvach, positive, the opponents of Rav Kook think is a negative, that if he just remained like he was in Chutz Aretz, things would be different. Yisrael says, what's Rav Ochanan wearing on his head? That's the hat that Ira's going to get me. Or someone's going to get it for me. That's the couple. Take a look at Rav Unterman. Take a look at Rav Moshe Feinstein. Take a look at Rav David Lifshitz. They all wore those. His is a little higher, maybe, but that's what it is. His goes up a little higher on his head. Theirs look a little shorter. But that's the old Lithuanian rabbi's garb. If I could show you pictures, maybe I will. In future classes, I'll have pictures. You see Rabbi Chanan, he always dressed like Lithuanian Rosh Hashiva. His son, there's a picture of him with his son. His son is wearing the white suit because Yeshiva Bachar in those days wore white. But that is the couple. Although you're correct, Israel, it's a little high for a couple, but that's what it is. Chazanim wore them, yes. This picture, when it's enlarged, I mean, the eyes, I mean, this is really a great picture. I don't know when it was taken or where it was taken. We have pictures where we know they're taken. In Europe, there's a picture of him on the boat going back to Europe after coming to America. We have pictures in America. But this, for some reason, has become the most famous picture, I think because of the look you see. Okay, I'll wait. Ira and Yisrael are typing. I'll hear what they have to say, and then I will wish you all good night. This semester, I have new people listening, and so that's good. All of you who are listening, you know, was Rav Leib Baron from, was indeed a Talmud of, Rav Leib Baron is from Montreal. He was a student of Rabbi Ochanan. As we will see, Baranovich was not a great yeshiva. It was a feeder yeshiva. So you went from Baranovich to the other yeshivas. I don't know where Vlade Baron went after Baranovich, if he went anywhere, but he might have come, come to the West. But, yes, Vlade Baron was a Baranovicher. Would Yiddish have been his first language? Of course. Yiddish is the first language of every Jew in Eastern Europe, secular or religious. The only ones who it wouldn't be would be the very, very assimilated who live in Warsaw. You had some who raised their, who would have, in the 1890s, 1900, would have been raising their children to speak Polish because they wanted to completely assimilate, but their first language, as the parents, would have been Yiddish. That whole culture was a Yiddish-speaking culture. This was not the case in Hungary. In Hungary, the Jews, including the Orthodox, not the Hasidim, but the non-Hasidic Orthodox spoke German in the West, and in Budapest, they spoke Hungarian. This would have not been the case in the Czech Republic, where they spoke Czech. So why is it the case in Lithuania and Russia? Because in all these places, in Poland, they didn't feel like they were part of society. In Hungary, you felt like you were Hungarian. You were Jewish, but you were Hungarian. You felt like you were French. You felt like you were German. No Russian Jew felt Russian. No Lithuanian Jew felt like they were part of Lithuanian culture. They were a separate entity in Poland. A tiny, tiny percentage might have thought that they were Polish. Everyone knew that they were different. They were a completely different ethnicity. They were a different culture. They were visitors, as it were, in that country. They never felt any nationalism, any sense of identification with the country. And they had their own language. The Gypsies had their own language. In Russia, in this former Soviet Union, you know, the Armenians had their own language, the people in Georgia, everyone. The Jews were a nationality. Could he have conversed in Hebrew? Obviously, as a great scholar, he could converse in Hebrew. What type of Hebrew it is? Rav David Lifshitz conversed in Hebrew, Ashkenazic Hebrew. He gave shiur in Ashkenazic Hebrew. I don't want to compare Rav David to Rav Elchanan, because Rav David Lifshitz knew Bialik and Chernikovsky. He also knew classic Hebrew. Rabbi Chanan Wasserman can converse in Hebrew like Rav Moshe Feinstein could. When the Sephardic chief rabbi of Eretz Yisrael, Rav Vlad Yosef, or Mordechai Aus met with Rav Moshe, he spoke in Hebrew with them. If you want to hear an example of that type of Hebrew, go on YouTube. You can search and find Mordechai Eliyahu, Lubavitcher Rebbe, or Mordechai Eliyahu came to Lubavitcher Rebbe. You have the cameras there. The Lubavitcher Rebbe is speaking to Mordechai Eliyahu in Hebrew, and not just Mordechai Eliyahu. Anytime one of these Israelis came to Lubavitcher Rebbe, he spoke in Hebrew. If you are learned enough and you know enough Jewish subjects like Lubavitcher Rebbe, you can speak in Hebrew, but it's not modern Israeli Hebrew. It's classic rabbinic Hebrew. And you'll use words that are not modern Hebrew, but that's so you can see the Lubavitcher Rebbe. He spoke in Hebrew just like that. Okay, thank you as well, Mel, and Chag Sameach to all of you, and we will pick up next week during Hanukkah, and that will be our last class next week. Good night. Good night, everyone. Oh, before you go, in case I forget, I'll mention next week, actually, because we have one more class before Nittel. And Baranovich has something to say about Nittel, Christmas Eve, and Baranovich. But we'll hold off on that till next week. Good night, everyone.